Good evening. James McKenna here with my Science Hour, November 21st, 2013. A lot of topics to cover tonight. I'll be talking about comets. That's certainly in the news. I'll be talking about the physics of certain attributes of comets, including horns, wings, long comet tails, and how do these occur? What's the physics behind them? And first of all, a couple of quick announcements. It's interesting that Thanksgiving next weekend falls on a Thursday. Well, oops, it always does. But Halloween also fell on a Thursday. And that, of course, is by day of the month, 31st of October. And talking about Halloween, on Halloween night, I gave some what I called scary stories. And I prefaced it by saying that I'm not very good at giving scary stories. But I kind of made up a couple of my own scary stories that were actually real scary stories. And one of them I said that insurance companies have no intention of paying you as a house owner, as a homeowner. And now I suspect that when a tornado goes through an area or there's, you know, a natural disaster like that, sure, they're going to come out and adjusters will be in that area. But I've been involved in situations like that. And they try and nickel and dime you. And, there's only one little thing over here that's affected. Therefore, this is how much we're going to pay you. And it seems like some people can scream and yell and jump up and down and kick and get more. And I always wondered how exactly you do that. But I've never succeeded at it. But what I said is that if your house, this is my scary story on Halloween, if your house is more than 10 years old, the insurance company has a long list of things that they can deny your claim. And the biggest one is that your house was not kept up to current standards. They use the current building code and building standards, even though you've been paying on your house insurance since the day it was built, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, whatever, 40 years ago. But they will tell you that your house does not meet current standards or simply doesn't meet standards. It's under... It's not properly constructed and therefore it doesn't qualify for an insurance claim. But they were happy to take your money for the last 40 years or 30 years or whatever, insuring a house that they never ever intended to pay on. The point of repeating this is because I got a lot of feedback, listener feedback, and cases all over the place. One woman said that she had a friend who was in the hospital. He couldn't shovel his roof. There was a heavy snow. The roof caved in, and the insurance company wouldn't pay because he had not kept the house up to code. But then, see, you're in this dichotomy between the county getting it up to code and then building standards, and they're not the same. They're not the same. But if you go to the county and say, well, I want to fix my roof a little bit here, well, they'll say, well, first of all, you got to pull out all the electric and bring it up to code, and then you got to pull out all the plumbing and put that up to code. Now you can fix your roof. And that's what the county's going to tell you. And they got in a building, license or whatever, license to build, permit, that's what it's called, building permit. And then the guy comes out, and you're going to $2,000-$3,000 for that, and the guy's got to come out and inspect your place, and you got to have all this, you know. Anyway, it turns into an impossible task for people to keep up with the codes because they're constantly changing. So at any rate, the end result is that this is a game that's being played by insurance. And I also got a feedback from a person who had worked for a company called Farmers Insurance, apparently one of the more famous companies for not paying claims. And there was a memo sent out to respective people within the company of Farmers Insurance, and the expression was, the corporate motto was, bring back a billion, with a B. And the kind of an odd expression, but what it meant was they were going to aggressively sell insurance and then not pay on claims, and thusly gain another $1 billion in profit for the corporate entity over the course of a year. Bring back $1 billion. And so, anyway, I thought I would add some of this listener input in, and so I got many, many claims from many insurance companies, all involved in the same game of not paying claims to homeowners. Based on a whole, and this is just a very long list, much longer than your arm, of reasons why they don't have to pay you on a claim for your house. Anyway, scary stories from Halloween, 2013. Just a quick mention, everything I say lately gets distorted, gets bent, gets twisted around. When I invented the term a short time ago that Mars would go comet, it spread like wildfire amongst the YouTube video nutcases out there, actually people who are sponsored by the government to create disinformation about this whole issue, about Comet Isa and the other comets and about the comet issue in general. And so now all of a sudden everybody's saying something's going to go comet. Whoosh! Isn't that amazing? But distorting it, twisting it, etc. And so I just wanted to mention this this past week. And it's good to identify these because some people think these are trusted sites. One of the least trusted out there is called Rumor Mill News. It's a CIA front operation. It has been since the day of its inception. They're out panhandling, trying to get donations. But don't listen to that. It's a front operation. And they're pushing the dirty snowball comet model. But here's what happened. I'm a guest on John Moore's show regularly every Wednesday morning, or just about every Wednesday morning. So we were talking about Comet Isa. This is from an interview probably within the last month. Some yo-yo takes the interview of me talking and John interviewing me, and we're talking, and I'm talking about Comet Isa going by Mars. And so they post a video, and the Rumor Mill News knows way better than to do this, but they do it anyway. They post this, and it's a video. And, of course, when I'm interviewed with John Moore, there's no video. Somebody pastes a video on top of this, and as I'm talking about Isa coming near Mars, causing Mars to go comet, it says, "This proves that Ison is Nibiru. Ison is Nibiru." And it keeps flashing on the video as I'm talking with John Moore. And, of course, they've cut and pasted this and then put it in a video and posted it on Rumor Mill News. And Rumor Mill News posts it and leaves it there. And so, obviously, trying to distort and change the message that, and, of course, I never said it was Nibiru. I've said 100 times. If I've said it once, that Comet Ison is not Nibiru. So obviously someone playing a little game there, but these people have handlers. They're people that are out there maneuvering them. But the point is that everything, anything I say is going to be twisted, turned, and woven through one of these disinformation websites. And like I've told people, don't go to these sites because they're just misinformation sites. And some people say, well, you know, they have good information there. I've seen good information. And I say, yeah, you need good bait to catch fish. So they need to put some, this is one of the key instruments of misinformation campaign. You've got to put some good information out there to draw people in to make you think you're legitimate. So at any rate, I'm not going to dwell on that, but just you have to be aware, and that's why I only post on my webpage, only give out information on my radio show or in bona fide real interviews with people like Joyce Riley, John Moore, Coast to Coast AM, and, you know, the long list of other people where I'm a guest, a long-term guest there. Okay, let me talk about the Ohio storms this past week and through Illinois, about 70 tornadoes. Some people wrote in and they said, well, gee, this was a record, the most tornadoes on the ground at one time. No, we've had systems in the last 10 years that had over 140 tornadoes. And I noticed recently there's more effort to claim that things are records that really are not records. For example, Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines had wind speeds up to 200 miles per hour. And they said, that must be a record wind speed for typhoons. No, back in the 90s, during the Hale-Bopp days, when we were having some real severe weather and some real popping going on the sun, nothing like the little baloney, phony baloney sun that we got going today, a couple little X flares, a couple little UV bursts, and they write about it for the next week. No, they were going off every hour or 2 hours back in the Hale-Bopp days. Off the sun. And so the sun has been very calm and collected, relatively, over the past weeks. But the point is, the Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines was not a record by any stretch of the imagination. It was a big storm. And the tornadoes that went through Ohio, as devastating as they were not records in size, in strength, nor in numbers. So, And I think there's an effort for news agencies to try and grab public attention by saying that these were records when they're simply not going back even into recent history, let alone far back into history. So at any rate, just a quick comment on that. And I'm not downplaying the devastation of these storms, not by any stretch of the imagination. It's simply that that was not a record, some kind of international record like they were claiming. And as long as I'm talking about the sun, I may as well give a solar update right now. We had a little pop the other day, and a part of it was Earth-directed, but certainly nothing major. We had some radio transmission interference, basically the sun has been relatively calm. Comet Ison, I'll be talking about, is racing in towards the sun. It has left the realm of Mercury. And by the way, I know NASA was taking data on Mercury with satellites that are actually in the region of Mercury and with other telescope facilities. None of that data is available. And personally, I did not have good viewing conditions to watch Mercury during the encounter of Ison, unfortunately. So, and of all the amateurs who have had good viewing conditions, none of them will post anything on Mercury. And so it's like they're very well trained. They only look at the comet. Well, that's the simple part. And then they can talk about that little fluffy snowball with all the Tier 2 mouthpieces out there. So, but basically, unfortunately, an opportunity missed. I was not able to view personally Mercury, and I have seen nobody else that has. And by the way, you'll see a lot of photoshopped, created photos, the people claiming that Mars went comet, and then they have some trumped-up photo. And that's just as bad as people making things up that Nibiru is here or something like that. That just creating photoshopping pictures and then posting them is as bad as just making up a story completely. But a lot of people did see Mars go comet. Some people saw it with the naked eye. That's how obvious it was. We had excellent viewing conditions for the Ison-Mars interaction there. And then, of course, Ison went ballistic, turned green, grew a spike, grew quite a bit, and then this past week, Comet Ison went six times its size in a number of hours, became blue and grew a second tail, all in the course of about a single day. Back on the and I talked about this last week. This week, Comet Ison has sprouted wings, symmetrical wings, and it's very funny to see the Tier 2 standard science antics going through saying, oh, that must mean it's going to split up. And they're waiting and waiting, and it's not splitting up. There's no peace coming off of it. And jets and streamers from a dirty snowball would come out asymmetrical. the wings on Comet Ison are perfectly symmetrical, which means they are spherically symmetrical. And I'll be talking about that, three-dimensional symmetry. That means that no matter what angle you look at that comet from, it's like a cone, so kind of imagine a cone. We all know what a cone looks like. We'll stretch the cone out, so it's kind of spherical in shape, and that's the shape. Now, if you look in my original papers, and you have these, if you have the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book, look in the appendices, and you'll find the three-part comet paper in the appendix. You'll see my original drawings from back in the 1970s showing what a comet would look like based on the electric field lines. And it's a combination of field lines of the comet and the sun, not just of the comet. And this is the infalling matter. This is the celestial mechanics problem that I solved, showing that the infalling matter would bundle up and come down the electric field lines, and that's the shape you get. It's predicted in the model. So if anybody has the book, the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book, and of course if you don't, it's available in e-format on my webpage, and of course in print form also. But anyway, look in the appendix. You'll see those original published papers from back in the 1970s, and you'll see my drawings, and that's you lay it on top of Comet Ison, and that's what you see. You see my drawing in Comet Ison. At any rate, I'll be talking about the physics of that, but this is three-dimensionally, spherically symmetrical. That means it's like a cone in three dimensions, and not just simply a cut through on a flat piece of paper. When we take a picture or a photograph or look through a telescope, we're imagining that that's on a flat piece of paper. But now what if you drop down to a different viewing angle or look from over here, look from down there, look from up there at the comet? You will see that same set of wings. And so what would the probability, viewed another way, what would the probability be of viewing the comet at exactly the right position to have those wings be symmetrical, and there's two just little faint little wings sticking out there? It would be mathematically impossible. And then as the comet moves, to always be on that right viewing point to see the wings symmetrical? No, this is a three-dimensional phenomenon. So no matter where you are, you're going to see those wings, because it's part of the physical structure of matter coming into the comet nucleus on the shape of a cone. But it's not a cone. It's like I say, take a cone and then stretch it out so it's kind of curved in shape. And there's I actually give equations for this. If you go in the appendix of the papers, the three-part comet paper, which is in the appendix of the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book, you will see the equations. There's a term I call the circle of equal force, which calculates and it shows the direction. It's all of these force vectors are calculated in equations, and so those are given. The equations define the position of these wings, and it gives them perfectly, as I said, and then I draw them out in photographs, and I have very long comets, I have short, fat ones. And Comet Ison is somewhat of a combination. You'll see the picture in the middle showing the wings exactly as you see them in Comet Ison in the photographs. So at any rate, I'll be talking about that in a bit more detail. First of all, I want to mention Comet Lovejoy up by the North Pole. And Comet Lovejoy is a huge comet now, naked eye visible in the northern, up in the northern sky, and developed a spike this week. So that's another, also turned blue. We have two blue comets, the Comet Ison and Comet Lovejoy, both turning blue, a nice brilliant blue color, meaning they're very energetic. That means the electrical current passing through them is energetic, and it's sufficient to drive the colors up into that blue. It's part of the spectrum. And remember, if you look at the rainbow, or if you take white light, what we call white light from the sun or from a white light source, and you divide it into its components, the order of energy is as follows. It starts in the infrared, and then it goes up into the red, and then into the orange, into the yellow, and that's where the sun is. The sun looks yellow. You don't want to look at it with your eyes because it's about 6,000 degrees surface temperature. Okay, from orange, to yellow to green, and remember that as you go through the color spectrum, for example, when you combine red with yellow, you get orange. And then when you combine the next stage up is if you combine yellow and blue, you get green. And so that's why when you're looking at the green comet and it looks green, you have to look for a specific component in there that's actually blue, because you're mixing the red, the orange, the yellow, the green, the blue. You're mixing all those together. And for a full, complete detail of that, explanation of that, that's what I talked about last week, was that combination of colors. That's why you have to have a trained eye when you look at the comet to see the bluish tinges in there that are on top of all the other colors, and as part of the spectrum, the overall spectrum coloration of the comet. And by the way, I got a kick out of this. The poor Tier 2 scientists at the official but unofficial NASA website for Comet ISON, they're trying to explain that, comets are green. That's only because they're taken with a filter. The pictures are taken with a filter. And I'm thinking to myself, what are these guys talking about? A filter removes some of the colors and lets other colors pass through. So if there's green light passing through the filter, then there's green light in the comet. And in fact, people are seeing these as green and blue. With the naked eye, with binoculars, they see it and they go, it's green, it's blue. Just like you look up in the sky and you see Jupiter, it's kind of an orangish color. You look at Mars, it's red. Your eyes pick up those colors. So when you see Comet ISON with the naked eye, it's blue. Comet Hale-Bopp was white, and because that was a big, big, broad coma. Comet ISON does not have a big, broad coma. It's a very long comet tail, and very narrow and very intense, because the electron beam is passing through the entire length of that that comet tail. They just announced that Comet ISON, the tail of Comet ISON, is 8 times the diameter of the Sun. Now, that does not mean the nucleus of Comet Hale-Bopp or Comet ISON. It does not mean the nucleus of Comet ISON is 10 times bigger than the Sun. It means that the length of the tail, a very thin plasma tail, and I'll be talking about that, the cause of long comet tails, what's actually going on there. The point is that a filter does not add color. It simply removes some of the colors that are already there. And then you see, if you see a green comet from a green filter, the green light is in the comet too. It's not like the filter adds light. And this is what the NASA webpage was trying to pawn off onto the public. Oh, it only looks green because it's in a photo, because it was taken with a filter. No. Boys and girls, this is physics 101, and so I don't know what these guys are thinking, or what they're smoking over there at Goddard, at Johns Hopkins, or the Naval Observatory. But filters only remove some of the light and let the rest pass through. So physics 101 junior achievers over there, Johns Hopkins, Goddard, and the Naval Observatory, Bathams, and Carrie Liss, and the rest of the boys. you can only laugh because it gets sillier and sillier every day. The standard Tier 2 explanation for why Comet ISON grew wings, they think it's jetting and it's splitting apart. And so they're waiting and waiting and waiting for this second chunk to come out of the nucleus. And guess what, boys and girls? It ain't happening. everything they try and explain with their Tier 2 ice ball dirty snowball comet model ain't working. And that's, you know, it's, I think the people out there are finally catching on, because every week we look at this, we look at their explanations, we look at the explanations, which I had long before these comets ever showed up on the scene doing what they're doing. Okay, so with that in mind, let me go directly into the explanation of how these comets work. But first of all, I'm going to do a little reading here. I just picked up, and I do this, I suppose like many people, before I go to sleep, I might pick up a book and just read, and it helps me kind of doze off a little bit and maybe dream about comets or something. So I picked up a book by a guy named Emmanuel Velikovsky. It's called Worlds and Collisions. And I happen to have one of the original 1950 first printing books. And so anyway, it's kind of a special thing here, but in hardcover. But anyway, here we are on page 201, and it says, he's talking about the priests of Iran. Now, this is in ancient times. They say that Venus began to move irregularly. Fear grew intense, and the priests of Iran prayed. And now, remember, this is, he's talking about many thousands of years, and actually the about 4,000 years ago now. These were the priests of Iran. It says, we sacrifice to Tistria, the bright and glorious star, for whom long flocks and herds and men, looking forward for him and deceived in their hope, when shall we him rise up, the bright and glorious star? Okay, and there's some other verses here. I won't bore you with all of this. You can read those for yourself. But here's the part I wanted to read. And the priest responded, he said, the next 10 nights, O Spitama Zarathustra, the bright and glorious Tristra, mingles his shape with light, moving in the shape of a golden horned bull. Okay, that's the part I wanted to get to. And then they're talking about the comet Venus, and that's what they're talking about here. Back in the old days, back in the, you know, about 1500 BC, this is the time frame. And once again, I want to just read this last line. It says, moving in the shape of a golden horned bull. So golden, what color is that? We're talking yellow. We're talking the intensity in a comet of yellow. Horned bull. Okay, and this is something I explained too in my original work. And by the way, when I was talking about comets with horns as a plasma effect, that was before I ever knew about Velikovsky. And that's just a little other historical record. I want to make that historical note clear, that some people think, oh, he's just trying to prove Velikovsky correct. He said, no, when I was at Cornell in 1979 and proposing the plasma discharge comet model, and I had already developed my celestial mechanics using electricity and magnetism included, and defining the shapes of electrical comets, the plasma discharge comet model. Remember, at that point, I had never heard of Velikovsky. So it wasn't like I was trying to prove something about Velikovsky. And at that point, I had some experiences in my life. And let me quote a couple of them. I had lived in, I'd done extensive traveling through Latin America, for example. And here's one incident that actually I had, and also I'd been at many archaeological sites, including Chichen Itza, Uxmal, and all of the sites through Central America, dealing with Quetzalcoatl. And it was obvious to me that Quetzalcoatl was the plumed serpent god of the sky. And modern archaeology does not recognize that as being a comet at all. But here's the story I want to recount. I was down in a small area in Mesoamerica, in Central America, with the Lacandon Indians. Now, these Indians, these people, were about 4 feet tall, and the women were shorter, and they were they were like a little bird, and they looked at me like I was a giant. But anyway, I came into a small hut where a woman had kind of like a little store almost set up, and you could get coconuts and other fruit. And she didn't speak Spanish, and she certainly didn't speak any English, and I didn't speak any Lacandon. And so anyway, it was about evening time. It was just about the sun was going down off the Caribbean coast, south of south coast in Belize, south of Tulum. And of course, that's before there were any roads. There weren't any tourist events there. That was it was strictly jungle. And behind her, up on a perch, was a quetzal bird. That's a bird of paradise with a long flowing tail. And I looked at it, and she looked up at the bird, and the birds roost during the day, and they fly at night. And as I stood there, this bird spread its wings and flew directly over my head. And I saw the pattern on the bottom of the wings of the quetzal bird when it's flying over my head with the long flowing tail. And it had the shape of Comet Ison. It had the shape of the winged comet. And that's why they call it the quetzal bird, named after Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky. But you would only know that if you saw the bird come off of its roost at that particular time of evening and fly directly over your head and see the patterns on the underside of the feathers of this beautiful bird. And so at any rate, the decades or many years later when I'm at Cornell, actually, you know, close to a decade later, I'm at Cornell doing my electromagnetic theory on comets, realizing the same forms and on also realizing that Quetzalcoatl really was the plumed serpent god of the night sky. It was it's probably 2 years later when I was first introduced to Velikovsky. And the way that happened, I was thoroughly, the whole issue of Cornell had come and gone. I had been in the physics department, then in the math department. And the whole conflict that occurred there with the astronomy department with myself. And a friend of mine called me up, and we were talking, and he said, you know, your work sounds like this Velikovsky guy. And I said, what do you mean? Who's that? You know? And he said, well, just here, he reeled off the names of the Velikovsky books. And he said, go check these out. So I did. And so I got a hold of Velikovsky's books and started reading, and I said, my goodness, this guy is talking about historical events that talk about the plasma discharge comet, a big comet, because I had already theorized that these could be big, they could grow bigger, some of them could become planet-sized, and then by the tail drag and by eccentricity damping, which is another effect of the tail drag on the comet, that means they can settle into a circular orbit. That's the method for a comet to become a planet. I had worked out all the theoretical details. So I said, this Velikovsky guy is talking about a plasma discharge comet. And so at that point, I put this together, and then the archaeology came flowing through. All of these things that I had done, I had stumbled around the globe following my nose, not really knowing why I was doing what I was doing or where I was going or why I was seeing what I was seeing. But putting this together, the quetzal bird, Quetzalcoatl, the archaeology in the Mesoamerica sites, the pre-Columbian artifacts dealing with the plumed serpent god, etc., all pointing to the fact that this comet, Quetzalcoatl, eventually became the planet Venus, and this was the core of the religions, of the mythology of the Incas, Aztecs, and Mayas. And it was completely misinterpreted and misunderstood by the archaeological community, and it continues to be today. So at any rate, with that in mind, now I'm going to talk about the wings of Comet Ison. Here we are in the year 2013, going into 2014. We have a comet up in the sky developing the wings of like the Quetzalcoatl wings. And how does that happen? Okay, so let's go back to Physics 101, Plasma Discharge Comet Model 101. And I'm going to bring you up to speed so you understand why the wings form on the comet and what you're actually seeing here. And remember, keep in mind that it is a three-dimensional symmetry. In other words, no matter where you are, where position your eyes are at around the comet, well, no matter what viewpoint you're viewing from, you're going to see the wings, and because what you're seeing is a cross-sectional cut, a plane that runs through the middle of the comet perpendicular to your line of sight. In other words, like take a big flat screen, you're looking at the comet, pass your big flat screen through the middle of the comet and look and see what is the image that you're seeing on that screen by cutting through the comet. And that's going to look the same no matter which way you slice the comet. Okay? You're going to see the wings because it is three-dimensionally symmetrical. Okay, so now let's get into the physics of how a comet works. The plasma discharge comet model, the other part of a lot of the physics, and remember that my modeling did not just include comets. That's one actually very small part of the entire overall solar system dynamics. It begins with the fact that the surface fusion, or the fusion of the sun, is up at the surface. It's not in the core. And there again, when I was at Cornell, I sat down and I talked to a guy named Hans Bethe, who is one of the principal authors of that model. And he goes, yeah, there's some problems with this. It doesn't, so there's some things that don't add up. And I told him, I said, look, the fusion is up at the surface of the sun. And he was very interested in that particular concept. He was so interested in my work, he pointed me in the direction where my work was finally beginning to be published in the European journals in the Netherlands, which he knew about. And he said, try there. He says, you're going to get your work published there. And it was, until the boys in the astronomy department got a little bit edgy about me publishing, using their data to publish work that contradicted their hallowed little theories. Oh, well, anyway, big life in the big city. So at any rate, the fusion of the sun is at the surface. Around this creates a superatom. The sun is actually a superatom, positively charged on the atmosphere with a sea of relativistic electrons moving around it like a superatom. And so what happens when the nuclear explosions, the fusion explosions, occur in the solar atmosphere, the protons come blasting out towards that electron screen. The screen opens up and the protons come blasting through. This gives an overall excess current of positive charge of protons in the solar wind. These protons continue out past the orbit of Jupiter, past, at the time I thought it was Jupiter. If you read my original papers, because we had not sent probes at that time, when I was working on this in the 70s, that was the farthest we could imagine because probes had not gone beyond Jupiter. Once the Voyagers and the Pioneers started getting out there farther and farther, then everybody realized, hey, that solar wind keeps going. It's way out there. And it actually continues beyond Pluto. So you'll see in my earlier writings that I actually talk about it being the what I called the nebular ion cloud, which was the termination of that solar wind, being around the orbit of Jupiter. But we're later to find out, as real data came in, the boundary of that was pushed out farther and farther, all the way out beyond Pluto. So at any rate, basically what happens is you end up with a capacitor. That positive charge flow cannot continue forever and leave a more negatively charged sun, more and more charged negatively, and this process So there has to be a return current sheet, and that's also a major discovery that I discovered that one of the return current sheets occurs where Earth is in the month of August. That's why the hurricanes, the auroras, that's why the tornado season all peak in the month of August, because we are passing through that return current sheet. That's why many times the solar wind seems to pause and almost stop when we're in the month of August, yet it's the most aurora-prone month, it's the most hurricane-prone month, right in the center of the hurricane season. So at any rate, and of course that varies and there are many other variables, but that's one of the big factors. Okay, what does this have to do with comets? Well, comets discharge this solar capacitor, and everything in the solar system discharges the solar capacitor. Earth does, Jupiter does, all the planets do, all the comets and all the asteroids. As we found out the other day, there was an asteroid that went comet, went ballistic on us, developed six tails, and it's just one of those mysteries that Tier 2 science can't explain, and they just kind of brush it under the carpet and walk away pretending like it never happened. Clearly that asteroid went comet. And they admitted it was, they had been watching this thing. It was too hot. It couldn't have had any water on it. It went comet. The only thing you can say, plasma discharge comet model. Okay, so at any rate, the comet is discharging the solar capacitor. And what happens when this discharge begins? Well, in the sun, right at the surface of the sun, the solar corona is a sea of electrons. They're free to move, and when they see that discharge, that path being cut by the comet nucleus, it sends out a streamer, or the streamer basically follows that path out to the comet nucleus, and that's the bulk charge carrier in the entire discharge. And guess what? It's invisible. You cannot see it. There's no trace of this electron beam until it gets near the comet nucleus and starts to create X-rays. That's the source of X-rays to the sunward side of comet nuclei. So that's one of the almost invisible effects that I predicted in my very original work. And I said, this is what's going to set this apart from any dirty snowball comet model that ever existed. You're going to find X-rays far out to the sunward side. In 1996, by accident, they found the X-rays. And exactly where I predicted, exactly how I predicted. And that's one of the many, many invisible aspects of comets. Okay, but that electron beam now continues out and around the comet nucleus, and it keeps going. It keeps going. Many times for 20, 30, 40 million miles, it keeps going. It's part of the overall solar discharge, the discharge of the solar capacitor that's following that comet nucleus. And one might ask, well, why does it follow the comet nucleus? And for that, I use the example of the backyard bug killer. When the backyard bug killer is a set of electrical grids, screens, and the outside one is at ground potential, so you don't kill yourself with this thing. And then the inside one is at a high voltage. There's no current passing in this. It's just a high voltage capacitor with a fluorescent light in the middle to attract the bugs. When the bug flies between the screen, he comes in at ground potential. When he flies in, it's like a finger sticking in there, and it discharges the capacitor exactly where the bug is. Zap! The bug gets killed, the bug falls down, no more discharge. The bug is the thing that causes the discharge. The discharge always occurs where the bug is, and that's like the solar system. The same situation. The only thing is, in the solar system, the discharge doesn't stop. The bug, which is the comet nucleus, which is just a piece of rock, or whatever it is, just something, it comes in and it discharges the solar capacitor. As the electron beam comes out and meets it, it's like a rock in a stream. There's a pressure that builds up, and it causes a negative charge buildup around the nucleus. This is the way I explained it in my original papers. And this is exactly what's going on. And you can, these are the verbal terms. You can also show this, as I did, in terms of mathematics. Okay, now what happens? Any ions that are in the area, anywhere out in that area, in that tail area, are going to start to be attracted to this negative charge. But they're going to move relatively slowly. They're not going to move as fast as the electrons in the electron beam, and you're going to have a nice cloud of electrons always around the nucleus, keeping that nucleus negatively charged. The positive ions come in. As the positive ions come in, they start to combine the oxygens with hydrogens to make water, the oxygens with sulfur to make sulfur dioxide, the hydrogens with carbons to make the oil, the naphtha. And also there's an effect that any little grain of sand or dust or small rocks or anything in that area that have a metal in them by the induced electric dipole force will attract them in, and these will start to follow the nucleus also. So these are just some of the side effects. But, okay, now we have the materials coming in, we have the water forming, and we have dust particles. Any dust particles that are out in space, typically a little bit of ultraviolet light knocks some electrons off of those. They're positively charged. They come drifting in. That's what forms the dust in the comet tail, and that's a lot of what you see. Now, when the electron beam continues through around the nucleus and out through the comet, that's where the electricity comes that lights it up like a light bulb. Now, in the Velikovsky Worlds in Collision books, they talk about the golden horned bull up in the sky. Venus was golden yellow. That is the color of the spectrum, of the heat spectrum of Venus at the time. Remember that comet Ison turned blue, turned first green, then blue. Comet Lovejoy was first green, then blue, becoming more intense as the intensity of the electrical discharge increased. You see how all of this is explained, everything we're seeing. But what about the horns of the bull? What about the winged comet, the Quetzalcoatl, the winged bird, the plumed serpent god of the night sky that looked like the underplumage of the Quetzal bird? Those wings, okay, if what I did with the comet model, I was dealing with mathematics, and I designed what I called the circle of equal force. That was a region electrically within which anything would fall in towards the comet nucleus. Outside of that region, the sun dominated, and it would not fall into the comet nucleus. So then I took the combined electric field of the solar wind, the sun, and the comet nucleus, and I created field lines, and those are the paths. Those are the paths that the ions, that the positively charged molecules would follow into the comet nucleus. And if you look at the drawings that I made, I produced, based on those field lines, you see the wings of the comet. You see it in the drawings. So that's what we're seeing. We're seeing the material come down the electric field lines and into the comet nucleus. And as I said, this is not just in a two-dimensional plane, this is in three dimensions. So they're coming down in a cone-like surface around the comet nucleus and coming into the comet nucleus. So no matter what angle you're at, no matter what position your telescope or your eyes or your binoculars, no matter what position, you're going to see those wings symmetrically spaced on both sides of the comet nucleus. Let's jump off to standard science, dirty snowball comet model. The only thing they can say is, oh, that's jetting from the nucleus. Well, gee, isn't that amazing that for days and days and days, the jetting coming out one side of the nucleus is perfectly equal to the one coming out the other side of the nucleus. And not only that, you just happen to be lucky enough to be all the time on the plane, perpendicular to the plane where these jets are coming out. Well, the nucleus is tumbling in there. It's not static. And so these jets would be coming and tumbling around and coming out in all directions and moving around. And that's not what you see. That's not the observation. So then they say, well, the nucleus is splitting apart. So we're going to see another piece of the nucleus come out eventually. A big fanfare of articles were in the popular media saying that Comet Ison was about to split up. Well, guess what, boys and girls? Days and days and days later, ain't no split up. So everything they try and explain doesn't work. And like, now, a long time ago, recently, I talked about a property called symmetry. In fact, for my new release coming up at Christmas time, one of the properties I talked about was the symmetries in nature. And if you have a theory, no matter what it is, to the formation of galaxies, how snowflakes form, no matter what your theory is, if there's symmetry involved in the end product, in the snowflake, in the galaxy, your theory has to accommodate that symmetry. Not just once, not by some quirk of a computer simulation that might possibly happen once. No. It has to happen all the time as a natural result of the theoretical work. And so, standard science, zero. Plasma discharge comet model, 100%. And that's what I'm saying. The plasma discharge comet model shows perfectly why the wings of the comet, why you always see them perfectly symmetrical. It's the same. Now let me go to the... This is a flowing back. This is on the tail side of the comet nucleus. You see the material coming into the nucleus symmetrically along those field lines, and that's why it forms the wings. And that's why no matter what angle you're at, you see the wings exactly perfectly symmetrical. But now let's go to the sunward side. This is where Velikovsky is talking about the horns of the bull. Because the ancients weren't so stupid as to think that the tail side of the comet was the front. No, they knew that that was the tail side, and the orientation of the comet with the tail, like the back of an animal has a tail, the tail of a comet is the tail. But comets do sprout horns, and guess what? Comet Lovejoy and Comet Ison both developed sunward spikes. And in the case of Comet Ison the other day, a fan-shaped horn set up on the sunward side. Now, Comet Ison also, after its stint with Mars, prior to it arriving at Mercury, developed a sunward fan-shaped plasma display. You might call it a plasma display. What's that all about? Well, okay, the horns of the bull. Remember that the comet has around it what I call the circle of equal force, and it's kind of offset. It's not a perfect circle. It's a circle, but it's moved with the comet near one side of the circle. So the wings of the comet that I was talking about, the wings that are on the tail side, can also form on the sunward side. So just as you get that beautifully symmetrical set of wings on the tail side of the comet, you can get the proton influx, the protons that come from the solar wind and are energetic enough to break through that circle and come in to the zone of control, you might call it, the circle of equal force, to cross that boundary and start coming into the zone of the comet nucleus, where the nucleus of the comet controls. They start to follow the field lines in towards the comet nucleus, thus the horns of the bull. And so all of this not only is explained, I predicted this. I said, this is what you're going to see in an energetic comet. You're going to see horns like a bull. And then later when I discovered Velikovsky's work, can you imagine I'm reading Velikovsky talking about the ancients seeing horns of a bull on a comet? And I'm going, This is my theoretical work, personified in the vision of Velikovsky. And you can imagine my awe, I'm strictly in awe, looking at highly paid NASA space scientists, astronomers, people like Carl Sagan, people like, the whole laundry list of astronomers, astrophysicists, and space scientists at Cornell, and they have no clue at all what any of this is about. They're seeing data at Jupiter from the Voyager spacecraft, from Pioneer. They're seeing the data from Venus come back, showing that Venus is a steaming hot planet with sulfuric acid raining out of the sky with a surface hot enough to melt lead. And they don't know what they're looking at, so they start making up fairy tale science, the kind of science that's being pawned off today on the public. The only thing today is I've got this radio show, and everybody out there is listening, and believe me, more and more people are listening every week, including a lot of scientists. And they're sitting back and they're going, this guy's right. He's been right all along, and he's drug his tail through this entire series of decades up to this point, and we're all looking up in the sky right now, and we're seeing exactly what he's talking about. What he's talking about is personified, and not only that, you don't have to go and get a PhD in astronomy to learn about this, because he can describe it so that everybody, including kids and grandmas and grandpas and truck drivers and secretaries and PhDs in chemistry and physics and everything else, can understand it. So, at any rate, that is a good summary of what we are seeing in the sky right now with Comet Ison, and it becomes more energetic. Comet Ison every day is more energetic. It grew its tail out to about, I don't remember the length, I think the last length was 16 million miles, and continues to grow longer and longer, and there again, that's drawing in that material from way out there. Remember, the Comet Ison is moving directly at the sun, so the tail is pointed straight out away from the sun. It's dragging material in from a great distance, and the electron beam is coming out contrary to that motion of, and illuminating all of that material, so that the whole comet is just lit up like a big light bulb, a big neon light bulb up in the sky. So this is going to be a real light show. There's more complexities coming every day, including the fact that Comet Ison has lost a little bit of its orbit. It's fallen behind schedule a little bit. And so that I'll talk about next week, some of the details. Remember to visit my webpage, jmccsci.com. That's JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com. And I'm out of time. Thank you for listening. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.